Well, welcome. This panel is focused upon U.S. leadership in global health. Congresswoman Barbara Lee was intending to be with us on this panel and sends her regrets. There was an unforeseen challenge that she needed to address in her constituency in Oakland, California. And so she's not with us today, but sends her regrets. What we are hoping to do today is have a lively discussion around what have been the achievements in this last decade through U.S. leadership and partnerships. What are the outstanding areas of outstanding challenge, the unfinished business, the critical priorities looking forward into the next Congress and the next administration? What are the critical choices going to be? Dr. Thomas Frieden, head of CDC and familiar to all of you. Yes?
Swap the microphone.
Excuse me. Can you hear me now? Okay. Do I need to start over? Dr. Frieden has agreed to set the scene for us and take a few extra minutes and talk about the achievements and the outstanding business and the critical choices that lie before us. And so he's going to take a few minutes and walk us through that. I don't think there's anyone better equipped from his background and from where he stands today in leading CDC to help us think this through. After that, I will turn to our other two panelists, Congressman Hank Johnson and Dr. Mark Rosenberg, the head of the Global Health Task Force here in Atlanta, to hear from them on their thoughts. Dr. Johnson, Representative Johnson, we've asked to focus on some of the outcomes from his trip to Ghana and Liberia with CARE earlier this year, and some of his thinking on the use of global health investments as soft power. Dr. Mark Rosenberg, as head of the Global Health Task Force, has pioneered much work on collaborations in this area and taken a very special interest and had high impact in bringing our attention to neglected tropical diseases, among other key challenges. So, Tom, could you please, if you wish to, by all means. Thank you.
Well, good morning, everyone.
Good morning.
It's great to be with you. And I really want to thank you for coming, for the invitation to speak. I want to recognize Senator Isaacson for his fantastic leadership in global health. And also really thank Steve Morrison, who has been a leader and a partner, incisive in his thinking, and always right at the cutting edge of the key issues in global health. Helene Gayle from CARE and Wayne Lourd from the World Affairs Council for organizing the summit and for their commitment to global health. When I finished all of my training programs, my first job was as the tuberculosis control officer for New York City. And at that time, there was a really big outbreak of highly drug-resistant tuberculosis spreading through the city. I was young, it was my first big job, and I really had no clear idea of what I should do. So I asked everyone I could, what do you think I should do? And through personal contact, got advice from James Q. Wilson, who passed away just last month, but was really one of the leading thinkers about the role of government and what makes for effective government. And the message he sent back was, I think, very relevant to our conference today. If you want the government to accomplish something important, you'd better make sure there are people outside the government pushing it to do so. Because that's the only way you're going to ensure that not just now, but as one of the speakers on the video show said, for 5 or 10 or 20 years to come, there's going to be pressure to do the right thing. The U.S. has been a leader in global health, and I'm privileged to direct the Centers for Disease Control, which really is the de facto reference laboratory for the world, but also provides the key epidemiology and information, keeps us safe from threats, and helps build institutions and information around the world. Senator Moynihan used to say that you're entitled to your own opinion, but not to your own facts. And one of the things that CDC tries to do is to ensure that we actually grow our common ground of facts that we can stand on. But CDC doesn't do this alone. We do it in partnership with organizations throughout the US, public and private sector, faith-based and community. We do it with multilateral and bilateral organizations. We do it with host country governments and with organizations in host countries. And through all this, we've made tremendous strides. And I want to talk about a few of the key trends over the past decade. The first and biggest is PEPFAR. And it's sometimes too easy to forget just how bad the HIV epidemic has been. This is an epidemic that resulted in the fall of life expectancy by more than a decade in countries throughout sub-Saharan Africa, as well as throughout the world. Enormous changes. A colleague of mine worked in Malawi for more than 20 years, and he describes working there from before the HIV epidemic hit and then seeing HIV come in and just devastate hospitals, doctors, nurses dying, beds with two or three patients, mothers dying, infants dying, orphans being created. The only business expanding was the funeral business. A pall over the entire society. And then PEPFAR coming in, antiretroviral treatment coming in, and hope established. Not only has the PEPFAR program been the biggest public health program ever in the history of the world, but it's getting tremendous results. 4 million people who are alive who'd be dead otherwise. 600,000 babies, HIV negative, who would be HIV infected otherwise. And a substantial reduction in costs, a two-thirds reduction in health, in costs for treating people for HIV around the world, and increasing commitment of host governments and host institutions and host communities to addressing the epidemic. There's plenty of unfinished business. We now know that if you treat one person for HIV, you reduce the risk that they will spread it to others by 96%. Treatment is prevention. For more than a decade, there was a debate of treatment or prevention. Now we know that treatment is prevention, and we can make a huge difference. But we have much more to do to get control of the HIV epidemic, but we're well on the way because of PEPFAR, the biggest program ever, and one that has been critically reliant on the private sector and faith-based organizations. And as I think many of you know, throughout much of Africa, a quarter or more of healthcare is provided by faith-based organizations. They often, I would say, they usually do so with a higher level of care and often with a lower unit cost per care than other organizations, public or private, in those communities. So they've been critically important partners for CDC and others in the PEPFAR program. CDC is a core implementing partner of PEPFAR. We account for about half of all of the treatment and the prevention of mother-to-child transmission. Most of certain other components like blood safety, now you can get safe blood throughout Africa. And we've used it to strengthen systems. So now you have laboratories that you can rely on the results when you get them in Southern Africa. So I would say PEPFAR biggest. The President's Malaria Initiative fastest. Malaria control is very rewarding because you can get very quick results. In fact, through the President's Malaria Initiative, 90 million people have gotten insecticide-treated nets. Almost 150 million people have gotten treated for malaria. And we've seen death rates, not just from malaria, but from all causes, fall by 15 to 50 or even 60% in the focus countries. In these countries, you see amazing things. I was in Ethiopia and saw in a small rural village, 5 years ago, they had 100 cases of malaria. And throughout Africa, malaria can account for a quarter or a half of all visits to healthcare facilities. It can account for half of all blood used. And in this village, through bed nets and even with rapid testing, so they'd been checking, for the past 5 years, they'd had zero cases of malaria. It's a dramatic result. The challenge with malaria is persistence. to continue implementing the program. The nets don't last forever. They have to be replaced or redipped. We have to continue treating. We have to address the emergence of resistance and the awful use of monotherapy with the best medication we've got, the artemisinins. This is a great gift to humanity. It's a great global story. It comes from a Chinese herb, and the Chinese government helped to develop it and industrialize it so that we could use it. It's now what you or I would take if we got malaria from most of the world. And yet, it's like a precious resource that we will lose if we don't protect it. And I think it's a good example of that key collaboration between the public sector, the private sector, and the community, and community organizations. Because in malaria, you have so much that's wonderful. Groups like Nothing But Nets that have raised money and awareness from throughout the country. Companies in Africa that have funded malaria control because it's good for their business. They don't want their workers out sick so much. But you also have a clear role for government. And one of those roles is to crack down on the manufacturers of drugs that should not be getting manufactured and should not be getting sold, because they will lose that class of drugs, the artemisinins, for all of us. So there are certain things that only government can do and certain things that government can only do with public support. So biggest PEPFAR, fastest malaria, longest lasting polio eradication. We are so close to the finish line. In 1988, when CDC and three other organizations started polio eradication with Rotary International as the lead and initiator of that initiative, there were nearly 1,000 kids a day disabled by polio. Last year, there were less than 1,000 kids disabled by polio in the entire year. Today, there are fewer countries and fewer districts in those countries with malaria spreading than ever before in human history. We've made tremendous progress, but we're at real risk of losing the battle. We're at the finish line. We can either drop the ball or get over the finish line. If we get over the finish line, it's going to save something like $50 billion in the coming decades. If we lose, if we don't get over the finish line, and Nigeria, Pakistan, and Afghanistan will be crucial for that, then really I think it will be a huge blow to global health. Vaccinations beyond polio are one of the great gifts to humanity. The measles initiative, which has also been a public-private partnership, has resulted in more than 4 million additional lives saved over the past decade. And we've got more to do with rotavirus and pneumococcal vaccination and new vaccines on the horizon. A wonderful program in Africa scaling up right now on the meningitis vaccine, a terrific partnership of the Gates Foundation, of PATH, of ourselves at CDC, and a number of other organizations. Meningitis is a terrible disease, and the so-called meningitis belt through Central Africa would result in tens of thousands of deaths and hundreds of thousands of disabled people. And the vaccine, a conjugate vaccine, has been made for 40 cents a dose with an Indian company. It's very highly effective. It's quality assured. And the vaccine efficacy from our initial studies is extraordinarily high. We haven't even documented any vaccine failures so far, despite looking. So a dramatic change. So vaccines can be the most sustainable, longest lasting. Now, WASH, which is the core concept in the Atlanta Declaration, water and sanitation, crucially important and maybe the broadest. It goes back to the roots of public health, clean water. 2 billion people around the world gained access to clean water in the past 20 years. The proportion without access was reduced by half. And yet still, nearly 1 billion people don't have access to clean water, and 2.5 billion, half of the developing world, lack access to sanitation. The result is more than 1 million deaths. And that's not just an impact in the acute event. So we know now that every episode of waterborne disease not only creates the risk of death and healthcare costs, but stunts that child, results in that child not growing to their full potential, sets them back months on their growth curve. And we now know that not only will that result in them being less healthy, but it will increase their risk of chronic disease later in life. It'll increase their risk of diabetes, heart disease, cancer, and stroke as they grow up. So there is an enormous opportunity to expand water and sanitation. And I think we need to take an all-of-the-above approach. We need to figure out ways to do point-of-care or point-of-use, where you can chlorinate, and we have safe water systems that we've done at CDC with support from Procter & Gamble and other companies that are now reaching tens of millions of people around the world and protecting them. We also need to build water systems in public and private use. And whether it's public or private, we need to get people to pay for them because they're not free and they need to be sustained. When I was living in India, in many of the informal settlements, there was access to water and electricity because people just, you know, plugged in to a public system, didn't pay for it, and resulted in the degradation of that system. It's not sustainable. One of the things that South Africa has done over the past few years is to put into the poor areas regular electrical supply that's metered. And people now understand that they have a right to rely on that being present consistently, and they're going to have to pay for it. There's nothing wrong with that. That's important. You need a sense of community ownership and community investment. In Haiti, we're dealing with a cholera epidemic, and we've been able to save 9,000 lives at least by improving the treatment of people with cholera. The only way we will control cholera in Haiti is the way it's been controlled everywhere it has broken out, and that is by improving water and sanitation. When Peru was hit by cholera in 1990-91, Peru and Latin America improved their water and sanitation systems, and cholera was essentially eliminated. Haiti can do this. It's possible, but it's going to take a focused approach and investment. And we know that the payoffs, the return on investment from water, may be $5 to $50 for every dollar that you invest, because not only does it reduce illness, increase productivity, it encourages people to be in different parts of the country so you can strengthen different cities and reduce the over-urbanization of some areas. You can encourage the development of business and schools. You can increase or reduce absenteeism at work and school. So it's a tremendously important investment. Now, we also need to think about the future and sustaining our progress. At CDC, we've helped to detect and respond to literally hundreds of outbreaks. In the past 3 years, we've trained more than 700 disease detectives in countries around the world in 2-year rigorous courses so they can figure out what's happening and stop it. We've, since 2009, helped stop more than 500 outbreaks or other threats around the world, working in dozens of countries, helping to discover more than 28 new pathogens or pathogens that were not known to exist in different places. This is work going on every day around the world. But the most important thing we do in those efforts is to help the host country to do that better, to train people to identify problems and respond to them. We have lots of problems still. We need to challenge the world because no one organization, no one entity can do this alone. We need countries to step up. We need companies to step up. We need people to work together more effectively so that we can get the synergies that partnerships allow. And for that reason, I'm so excited about the Atlanta Declaration, because I think Atlanta really is a global center for health studies, for health practice, for health improvement. Atlanta has a wonderful history of social justice, and really the moving force behind our work in global health isn't just that it's good for us because it protects us. It isn't just that it's good for us because it makes the world more stable. It isn't just that it's good for us because it makes our economies grow better. It isn't just because it's good soft power. It's because it's the right thing to do. And that social justice is really something that will get us over the finish line, because it is what makes us all come to work in the morning. It's what makes us all committed to improving global health. And it makes it possible to get through what are sometimes difficult partnerships, because we recognize that we really are all motivated by the same thing, that we're all connected by the air we breathe, the water we drink, and the food we eat. Thank you all very much.
Thank you, Tom, for that very eloquent and comprehensive view. And I'd like to ask Congressman Johnson if he would share his thoughts with us on how this looks from the vantage point of your constituency, your travels, your role in the Armed Services Committee. So please join us in welcoming Congressman Johnson.
Can I come up here?
Sure.
I'll take this opportunity up here so I can kind of lay out my papers. And good morning, everybody.
Good morning.
We live in a great country, United States of America, and we've been a great country and we will continue to be a great country, but I think it's important that we take a step for a second, take a step back for a second, and look, take a good look at ourselves, because you can't help anyone unless you are in a position to help them. And so is America in a position to help others? Yes, it is, and it must. But we must redesign our way of helping and our thinking in terms of how we help our friends around the world. I had the great opportunity to go to Africa back in January on a trip sponsored by the CARE organization, and we went to Liberia, and we went, which is, by the way, a place where African Americans actually transferred back to Africa back in the 1800s, 1822, I believe. And we also visited Ghana, and in Ghana we saw one of the castles from which slaves were boarded upon vessels that would make their way to America loaded with slaves. So we had a chance to go to the departure point, and we had the opportunity to come to the place where blacks came back to Africa. Now, which place was more developed? It would seem like it would be Liberia, wouldn't it? But it was Ghana. And we had to stop and ask ourselves, wow, how is that? Aren't those our friends over there? In Liberia, how have we historically treated our people? I'm talking about America, Americans, because after all, it was some black people who made the journey in 1607 to Jamestown, Virginia, first settlement established. 1607. It was some black folks on that boat. It was some black folks when America was going to war in, I believe it was Boston, and the shot heard around the world, or British are coming, the British are coming. What was that? That was, huh? Well, that's who I'm getting ready to talk about. I'm getting ready to mention the name of the first man to die in the Revolutionary War on behalf of the Patriots was a black man. And so, you know, we go way back, all the way to the beginning of this country, and then some of us left to go back to Africa, seemed like they would be our friends. So we gotta look at that history that we've had with our people in Liberia. But I can tell you right now there's good work that is going on in Liberia by organizations like CARE and other NGOs grants that are administered by those NGOs coming from yours and my taxpayer dollars. A country where in Ghana, between the age of birth and 5 years, it's an infant mortality rate of about 20%. That's pretty high. And infant mortality rates are close to 10%. It's about 8%, if I recall correctly. And what America, through its aid, is doing in that country is creating friends and winning over enemies, and in the process, creating a climate for prosperity to take hold, education, business opportunities. All of these things are coming together in Liberia, and it's under the strong leadership of a woman, Ellen Sirleaf Johnson, Ellen Johnson Sirleaf, president, Nobel laureate. She has plans for the country, and she is not a corrupt leader. She's a courageous person who has fought corruption and now leads that country and is very well educated, American education, experience in working in America. And now she's back in Liberia leading that country to a new realm of prosperity for all of its citizens, thus opening up great opportunities for people in America to do business there. And one of the things that we have to redesign in terms of doing business in places is to make sure that we give opportunities to the locals to develop businesses and to prosper, to become entrepreneurs, small business people, to have the kind of financing that they need in order to make their country stronger. That's the kind of help that we need to give. And we, just in taking care of those infants, the children, and the mothers, opens up so many opportunities for us. And so I was heartened to see what we're doing in Liberia. And the same thing when we went on to Ghana. Infant mortality rate is lower there. It's about 47. The estimate for 2012 is about 47 infants will die out of 1,000 live births, whereas in Liberia, 72, almost 73 of 1,000 will die at childbirth. But so Ghana is a little more is a developing nation. And even though the people may live in what you would consider to be huts, everybody's got antenna coming up out of it. And some electricity is going in, and people have cell phones, and they are communicating. But malaria is a big problem. Malaria is a tremendous problem. How much does it cost to equip every bed in Ghana, or every person, let's say if every person had the benefit of sleeping under a net that keeps out the mosquitoes that spread the malaria illness. I think those nets, those bed nets cost about 10 cents a piece. 10 cents apiece. And to get them out into Ghana, which is growing, roads being paved, bridges being built, electrical grids being established, water, clean water, and wastewater treatment facilities have yet to come online, but they are in the process. It's just so much opportunity there for basic infrastructure that is already taking place in Ghana, and we're helping to keep those women and children healthy, and it's going to pay off for us down the line. That's soft power in terms of creating friends and winning over enemies, to spend our dollars in such a way that that promotes healthy living. And it's a wonderful thing, but I tell you, we in America have to redesign our approach. And when I say that, I really mean that we personally have to redesign our hearts. If you think in terms of technology, we've got to somehow get to a point where we care about our own citizens, our own fellow citizens in this country. A gentleman made the remark this morning about the Obamacare, is what it's derisively called, the Affordable Care Act, which extends the opportunity to 34 million more Americans to receive, to have access to the healthcare system. What a wonderful thing by an African-American president, the first one elected in America, who happens to have a daddy that was from Kenya, Africa. We're all about Africa, right? We got the consummate president who, when he proclaimed himself to be a citizen of the world, he was derided, castigated, and chastised for saying that, because we here in America, we're thinking about America and what's best for us. And most of us, when we think about us, we're thinking about me and my family. And so the world is much bigger than just me and my family and my neighborhood and my community and my county and my state and my country. God bless America. God bless all nations of the world. I think we have to redesign our hearts to pull out a higher way of living. Each one of us should have a purpose, I believe, in living. And it should be more than just simply making a buck or telling folks what they have told you that they want to hear. Polling. What is the responsibility of leaders, of the leaders of our society, towards the people who we represent? It is to tell you the truth, and it is to educate you. It is to help educate you, or help to inspire you towards more education, because it can't be a top-down, it's got to be ground up. And so I want to challenge everybody in the room today to look at all of the African students. There's about 40,000 in the United States of America studying. Do we believe that Africa is a country of bush and savage people like Joseph Kony? Or is there another Africa that never gets portrayed in the media that helps to shape people's opinion about Africa and about Africans who are right here getting the greatest education on earth And like everyone else, they should want to go back home, but many of them want to stay here because there's no opportunity at home. Why don't we embrace them when they come and invite them into our homes and sit down and eat with them, introduce them to our culture and love them, extend a warm branch, olive branch, and then talk to them about what they think that we need. Those are the best and the brightest. And then let's inspire them to go back to their country, just like Nobel Peace Prize winner Ellen Johnson Sirleaf, and go back and contribute, bring new leadership to Africa, to your country. And we will help you do that. And so in that way, ladies and gentlemen, I think that that America will continue to make a big difference in the lives of people across the world and right here in America. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you, Congressman. Thank you. I will hear from Mark Rosenberg.
Well, thanks and good morning. It's really an honor to speak to so many of you and to hear from so many of you. This is an extraordinary collection of wisdom and experience, and I'm really honored and delighted to be part of it. Atlanta does have some amazing leaders, and I just want to point out for the benefit of some people who may not know this man sitting right here, the director of CDC, but I think CDC and America and the world are very, very lucky to have Tom, who I think is brilliant and has energy beyond what you can imagine that he brings to this job. So we are really, really lucky to have him in that position. And I hope that the U.S. will take advantage of this spectacular leadership that we have. I wanted to give just two comments. I was asked to comment about what should American leadership in this area of water and global health look like. That's kind of a daunting task, and I don't mean to say this is what they need to do, but I do want to say what I hope U.S. leadership can look like. The first is I hope that U.S. leadership will be based on real collaboration. There's an African proverb that says, if you want to go fast, go alone. If you want to go far, go together. To bring safe water to everybody who deserves it and needs it is far. We have a far way to go. And the only way we're going to get there is if we work together. But America, this may come as a surprise to you, and American leadership has a tendency to go it alone. And this is not going to get us where we need to go. It's not going to get us the partners that we need to have if we're really going to bring safe water to people who don't have it. We are rich, yes, but we're not that rich. And we are smart, but we're not that smart. PEPFAR, that you've heard the wonderful things it has accomplished, and it's extraordinary what it achieved, but it's an example of America going it alone. Mike Merson, the former director of AIDS at WHO and a dean at the Yale School of Public Health, wrote the history of the first 20 years of the AIDS epidemic, and he said that the biggest failure of the first 20 years of the AIDS epidemic was the failure to collaborate. The failure to collaborate could have made such an extraordinary difference in the HIV epidemic. PEPFAR accomplished many great things. One of the wonderful things it did was to bring about an extraordinarily fruitful collaboration between CDC and USAID. They don't always get along that well, but it showed what's possible, and it achieved the kinds of life-saving interventions you heard Tom talk about. But it basically was the U.S. going it alone, and I don't think we can afford that anymore. I don't think the people we need to serve and the people we need to reach can afford that. So it's really, really important that we go together on this water and global health journey. You've heard the song. I want to mention two songs today. Imagine by John Lennon. Imagine what we could have done with HIV/AIDS if the world had come together and if U.S. leadership had decided to take this on in a collaborative way. It's not only the U.S. that needs to be collaborative in leading this effort, but I think the big multilateral organizations like the World Health Organization, UNICEF, and the World Bank. The World Bank, which, by the way, is blessed now, you've heard, with the first Korean-American president of the World Bank ever. It's also the first physician, the global health physician, Jim Kim, who's going to be the leader of the World Bank. Again, an extraordinary chance for partnership. But even these big multilateral organizations are now seeing that their efforts are dwarfed by the big partnerships like the Global Fund and Gavi and UNITAID. These three new partnerships have more money for global health than these three big multilaterals put together. And they are seeing that they need to work in partnership. It's important all around, but partnerships and coalitions are difficult. They take a lot of work and a lot of effort. I always say that a coalition is like a marriage. It's very easy to get into it, and it's very hard to make it work. If any of you disagree that it's hard to make it work, you should try it. Try it and you'll see, I am sure. These coalitions are hard. It's hard to make a go of it. They take effort, focused effort on this. Yogi Berra, a world-class philosopher, a famous baseball player, who came from my hometown of Montclair, New Jersey, said when he got an honorary degree in Montclair, he said, in theory and practice are the same. In practice, they're not. In theory and practice are the same. We're very good at the theory of collaboration. We put together beautiful PowerPoints, publish wonderful articles, but in practice, we are not so good at it. And I do hope it's so critical that we can make our partnerships work, that we really invest in working with the countries, with our other partners, among the sectors that you've heard people talk about. And yes, even CDC and USAID work together on global safe water. So that's the first thing. I hope that U.S. leadership is based on real collaboration. The second thing comes from another song. You may have read that Bob Dylan is going to get the Presidential Medal of Freedom. I think it's going to be at the end of this month. And Bob Dylan had a song. And the song went something like this. It's all right, Ma. They're only dying. I think he said, I'm only bleeding. But I always used to think it was, it's all right, Ma. They're only dying. It's all right, Ma. They're just not drinking. This is not a threat to us if people are dying from drinking contaminated water or sick from not drinking water. And another philosopher in the class, certainly of Yogi Berra and Bob Dylan, is a philosopher of public health. He's the only philosopher of public health I know, and his name is Martin Buber. And he said there are two types of public health surveillance. He said one type only looks at problems that are threats to us. Problems that can be imported into our country, multiply drug-resistant TB, HIV, SARS, H1N1. This type of approach to public health says, I will look at those places and those people who pose threats to me, and that's what I care about. And Martin Buber said there's another type of public health surveillance, which he called I and Thou surveillance. And he said, I will look at people who are suffering, who are dying prematurely, and whose children are dying unnecessarily, because every life that's diminished diminishes me. I am connected to this world, and I don't just care about the threats to me. Well, I think that the U.S. leadership should take this second approach. I think that the U.S. leadership needs to see the faces. We need to see the faces of those who don't have clean water, who suffer from contaminated water or no water at all. It's a compassionate type of leadership that we need to have, but we really need to see those faces. And I think we need to realize that global health is not just over there. But as Tom said earlier, and Hank stressed with the Affordable Care Act and MDR-TB epidemics in New York, global health happens in Uganda and it happens in New York. Global health happens in Nairobi and global health happens in Atlanta. We are part of this global health world. And the more we can see it as one world where we have a very important connection to other people, the more likely we are to succeed. So the two things I would hope from our global leadership, again, are just that it's based on real collaboration and that it's compassionate. Finally, I end with a saying from Goethe. And Goethe said, "Knowing is not enough, we must act. Willing is not enough, we must do." We have a great challenge. It requires great leadership. And I think we have the potential to provide it. Thanks.
Thank you. We have about 13 minutes left. I'd invite people to come forward. We are going to center the balance of our discussion really around the question of U.S. leadership. We're in a period of austerity. We're in a period of a highly contested political rivalry, polarization, fraying bipartisanship, higher scrutiny of U.S. dollars. We've heard this from many of our speakers this morning. And so in the midst of this era that we're in right now, I'm hoping that we can steer our discussion back to the question of how do you sustain U.S. leadership? How do you sustain bipartisan foundation of support? Two very fundamental elements to where we've moved in this last decade. The dollars are no longer on a very steep ascent. They're flat or contracting resource base, but we have enjoyed substantial durability and resilience in Congress in keeping our global health programs and commitments at a robust level, even in under almost 3 years now of recession. So I'll invite people to come forward. I'd like to quickly come around and just ask our speakers in rapid succession, what are the one or two things, in your view, and I'm going to start with Dr. Frieden, as we look forward into this next administration and next Congress, if you were to encapsulate one or two key pieces of advice around sustaining U.S. leadership and sustaining that bipartisan foundation of support, the message that you would deliver, the one to two messages, then I'll come back to Hank Johnson and to Mark Rosenberg. Tom, can you share with us? And then we'll turn to our questioner, our audience members.
First is getting results. Every dollar we spend is a dollar that someone worked hard to earn and pay taxes. We need to make sure that every dollar we spend is getting results. We also need to include in that communicating those results and ensuring that they're sustainable, so building the capacity to get those results in the long term. But ultimately, I think Americans are willing to ensure that we support people around the world, but they want to know that it works. And that's why I think it's crucially important that we rigorously and honestly and accurately monitor what we're doing, communicate that effectively, and help countries establish systems to continue that progress.
Thank you very much. Well, that's a very important topic that we will be looking at later in the day when Molly Ann Brody and Liz Hamill present the Kaiser Family Foundation survey work, which focus very much upon American opinion on this era. Congressman, can you tell us what are the one or two pieces of the messages or pieces of advice looking forward to sustain U.S. leadership and bipartisanship?
I don't think there's any way to know what's going on outside of America's borders than to travel outside of America's borders and to travel with an open mind and to travel with a mind that is respectful of other people's cultures, a mind that's open towards equality. I think I've seen estimates that as low as 3% of members of Congress have passports. And I've seen it as high as 50%, but not over 50% of Congress people have passports. And some, I've heard reports of some who have stuck out their chest and held their hands high and proclaimed that I've never been out of the United States of America before, and said it with pride and dignity. So we have to change the way that we look at ourselves and how we look at the world, and we got to get out there and see it. We got to get out there and talk to other people. We can see how happy they are living despite what we consider to be poverty-ridden lives, but they're still happy. They love their children. They cry when the babies die. And so we have to see that. We have to feel that. And then when we come back, that helps to shape our policy making.
Thank you. Mark.
Well, thanks. If I were to add, I would reinforce what's been said, but I think about what would it take to sustain leadership in the same way I think about what would it take to sustain a marriage. That's the partnership I know best. It's one I think about every day. But I think to sustain a marriage, you need to respect the person that you are partnering with. You need to believe that they understand you, and you need to trust them. And I think that U.S. leadership needs to realize, not just leadership, we all need to realize that we have more to learn in the field of global health from our partners and our partner countries, from Niger, from Kenya, from every country in Africa and Asia and Latin America and the Caribbean and Europe. We have more to learn than we have to teach. We have a lot to learn, a lot to learn. And this could be a tremendously rewarding partnership for us. And again, we're smart, but we're not that smart. But we could be if we follow St. Francis's injunction. He said, seek first to understand and then to be understood. And I think if we approach our global health work with that notion in mind, that we have extraordinary partners out there and we will learn from them and trust them and respect them, that will go a long ways towards making it sustainable.
Great, thank you very much. What I suggest we do is we take together three or four quick comments, questions, very brief. Please identify yourself and then we'll come back to our panelists. Yes, ma'am.
My name is Ann Basarab. I'm with the Well-Being Foundation, and today I'm here. Tomorrow, my husband will be in our Maasai community drilling a well. We organized a team here, and in 3.5 years, we've raised $28,000 to put fresh, clean drinking water for 2,000 people in our community. And we're really too far out for care. Red Cross doesn't come to our area. So if we don't generate something here, it doesn't happen. Next project we're working on, really in two Maasai communities, is to do some HIV/AIDS counseling. And what I'd like to know is how can we get counselors who can speak to our community in Ma? Because a lot of the women, we have a lot of widows, they don't speak Swahili and they certainly don't speak English. So how can we get some counselors who can go into the villages and actually speak the unwritten language, Ma?
Thank you. Thank you very much. Yes, sir.
My name is Danny Cruz. I'm a director with GWAT Solution Partners in Washington. This question is addressed towards leadership in collaboration with the funding sources where we do have leadership in the U.S. And given that we just had the recent congressional battles on U.S. Ex-Im Bank authorization and the increase of their budget, it seems to me that we've been focusing a lot on USAID funding, but we do have the other agencies such as USAID, U.S. Trade and Development Agency, and MCC. So my question to the panel is, how are we looking at collaborating with the other funding agencies outside of AID to make sure the global health message and water messages get out and funded by those agencies? That's it.
Thank you. Kofi?
Thank you. Good morning.
Can you just identify yourself, please?
Yes. I'm Dr. Kofi Kondwani from Morehouse School of Medicine. And there's an African artist, musician, who has a song that's called Water Don't Got No Enemies. And his whole message was, of all of the things that go on around the world, if you have some ways to support water, you'll have no enemies. And I think that's the way this country should approach these water projects. But I want to ask about the richness of resources that we have, but not in terms of finances, but in terms of people from these countries that now either live in the U.S. or, as Congressman Johnson said, 40,000 are here studying. We don't have a program that matches people with the expertise that are needed in these different countries with people from their own culture that work or live in America now. We don't have a program where our historically black universities and colleges and medical schools can work with some of these funds like PEPFAR and go to these countries and contribute in a culturally competent way. And what I would like to see is that in the programs that are developed, that we keep that in mind, because these resources that we have here in America are from all over the world, and we're not doing what I think we can to bring them back and help them contribute to their own communities, which they would love to do if they had the opportunity.
Thank you, Kofi. Let's take one more. Yes, ma'am.
My name is Barbara Lynch. I'm at Georgia Tech, and I work on water governance issues in Peru. And I, too, was reminded of a Dylan song that I'm always reminded of when I'm in Highland, Peru. And it is, you know something's happening, but you don't know what it is, do you, Mr. Jones? And my question is, up in Highland, Peru, the people I work with that I interview are very often see themselves as facing water problems that they don't know what they are. Are they coming from climate change? Are they coming from mine waste? Are they coming from other industrial activities? And my question is, should we be focusing on these new and different issues? Or saying, hey, we know that we have problems with infectious disease and putting our money there.
Thank you. One last comment, question. Yes, sir.
Hi, my name is Damason Fomisaka. I think one of my biggest concern is that one of the major reasons why most of these projects are not sustainable is because you most of the time export policies to the country, and I'd like to reiterate the professor from the professor's view. Whenever you export policies and those policies contradict the culture and custom of the place in which they have to be implemented, there will be no motivation in sustaining those policies. And in terms of American leadership, Congressman, in developing countries, they call it corruption. In America, they call it lobbying and campaign contribution. I think Congress have put more emphasis on re-election than in the reason why they were sent to do their job in the first place. For instance, right now in the United States, to have a high education is a luxury. By the time I graduate, I'll be owing at least $100,000. And that's an average. The Chinese graduate hundreds of thousands of people every year. The difference is that when I have to go back and start working, instead of allocating my resources to further develop my community, I will be allocated in to pay my debt. However, the Chinese will allocate those resources to further develop the country. So maybe Congress should get more on the real ground and leave politics a little bit.
Thank you very much. We have just enough time to come back to our panelists for some comments on these questions. We had a question around language and assistance on at a micro level on the project in terms of counseling and appropriate language. We have a question around collaboration among U.S. agencies, and this is something CDC faces and lives with on a day-to-day basis. We have a question around tapping the skills and expertise of an American-based African diaspora. I have a question around water. How do we understand the roots, the actual roots of the problems? And then we have a question here around cost of education and the approaches that are taken and how grounded in reality are our approaches on foreign aid, on global health and water. Tom, would you care to touch on some of those?
I'll take three of them with just a sentence or two for each. First, in terms of the Maasai community, please talk to Dr. Patty Simone, who's sitting near you, and give your information, and we will follow up to see how we can link you with testing services. Really, where we've gone to with HIV testing is a provider-initiated model where it's a routine part of care for all pregnant women and for all people who come in for care. In terms of collaboration throughout the U.S. government, the leadership of the Department of State is one of the key elements in the progress and success in PEPFAR. And we think the ambassadors in country can look across the entire U.S. government. In Washington, you have the State Department and the White House committed to global health, and this is a core way that we can make sure that all parts of the government are being optimally utilized, and that the ambassador and the State Department serves as the key convening ground within countries, which is really as it should be. In terms of solving problems, just two comments. First is, we don't always know what the problem is. That's why it's so important to continue to figure it out, to continue to help countries develop monitoring or surveillance systems to identify problems. But we do know that improving water, where water is a problem, is going to have a very broad impact on infectious disease, on economic development, on productivity, on school performance and attendance, and ultimately on non-communicable disease as well, diabetes and heart disease and stroke.
Thank you. Congressman Johnson, some parting thoughts?
Yes. What is it about what is causing a lack of water? What role does mankind play in the rendering of water undrinkable? What can we do to stop hurting our environment? Because an environment is something that we all have to live in. What can we do? I think the question that was asked by the young lady at the mic over here was very profound. In addition to looking to spend money helping somebody through grants and aids, we can also look at the impact of our policies insofar as they hurt the environment and affect things like water quality. Exporting policy, we have to listen, we have to talk. I agree with the doctor here. We've got to hear from our partners around the world. What is it that you want? What is it that you need? We've got to have the kind of capability monetarily here in America that we can help you, and we can do so in accordance with your true needs and bringing about the diaspora and the students who are here temporarily to communicate, for us to communicate with them, for them to communicate amongst themselves, and for them to be able to go back home and make some discoveries that perhaps only we can help them with. That's the way that we can get kind of into a global pattern of thinking and communicating where everyone is prosperous and healthy.
Thank you very much. Mark, you have the last word.
Thanks, Steve. First, funders other than USAID, absolutely. There are many departments. You've heard about many sectors. The corporate sector can be good funders. There's a little there's a little foundation in Seattle that has a little bit of wealth. There's going to be another foundation that's part of Facebook that has wealth. So absolutely, multiple funders need to come together. The problem with water is it's so expensive to bring clean water to people. People get frightened off. And they say, oh, I want to do something that's small that my agency or my foundation can really claim as their own, and we can solve and we can finish it. The water situation is not going to be finished by any one organization, no matter how much money they have. So we've got to come together, and that will make it much more feasible. It will attract more people as we build a real funding coalition, matching African students with mentors from their own culture. That's a fantastic idea. And if that works, maybe we can start to match American students here in the United States with mentors, an untapped resource. But bringing people together with their mentors is a wonderful and very important idea. Shouldn't we focus on non-infectious causes of contaminated water? Absolutely. We've got to move on beyond infectious causes. And finally, exporting policies won't work, so we need to leave politics behind. I think, unfortunately, there is no global health without politics. And there is no politics without politicians. And I think what we can do is work to create a political leadership that is as good a citizen of this world as are Hank Johnson and Johnny Isaacson, people who understand, people who travel, who have passports and use them, and are committed deep in their heart to this cause of global health and safe water for all. I think what we can do is work to have the best informed political leadership that we can hope to have.
Thank you very much. Please join me in thanking our panelists.